Welcome to episode 123 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including 20 questions. I am Daniel Winter, and that is Ted, who you may hear as well.
Special guest, Ted, featured on this episode. We're pleased to be joined by Ted. My name is Mark Uessa, constant co-host, and happy to be here.
Yes, another episode. Lots to talk about today. A couple of special guests coming up in the next few episodes, so maybe the last one to run through some miscellaneous topics for the next little bit.
Yeah, and I know that your throat is not feeling great, so we're probably going to try and go easy on you, maybe a little bit more on me this episode. I'm totally fine with that. But if you're cool, shall we roll in with our three-course format?
Yes, I'll see how my voice holds up for now. Let's start off with the appetizer, I guess. Do you want to kick us off there?
Sure. Should we do, like, toss it back and forth?
Oh, Ted thinks yes. That's a good idea, yeah.
Sounds great. All right, I'll start with a little one. So, we promised that we wouldn't be promoting Microsoft games and Xbox games because of the BDS movement. We firmly support that. I'm not buying any Microsoft games. But I thought, just for historical reasons, that this little news tidbit was interesting. They are coming out with, it's a little confusing, it's called Halo Campaign Evolved. So as I understand it, this is a little bit different than the Combat Evolved that's in the Master Chief Collection. This is a remake of the campaign in Unreal Engine 5. And remakes are not that strange. We've been talking about them for weeks now. But what is news, notable news, I thought, is that they're releasing this for the very first time on PlayStation 5. So this is the first Halo game that will be released on PlayStation 5. I thought that was notable just to mark as a point of history. Microsoft is really going for multi-platform. I think it's a smart business decision. I know that some fanboys are not going to be happy about this. If there are any Xbox fanboys left, I don't know if there are. But I think overall for game accessibility and game preservation, I think it's not a bad thing. Maybe there are some Sony PlayStation diehards that have never even touched a Halo, so this would be a good opportunity for them to do that.
More like capitalism evolved, am I right?
It's true. That is the ultimate root of evil that these remakes come from. But hey, if you swore that you'd never have a Halo game on a PlayStation platform, well, you were proven wrong just now.
Yeah, it's hard to know what the purpose of this is. I mean, we've talked about the Halo games multiple times. We've reviewed the last couple of games in detail, and they've both, that's, that series means a lot to the both of us. The original Halo is the reason I got into first person shooter games. Essentially, I played a lot of that first game, but that whole series has just felt so misguided and wayward the last few years. It doesn't really seem like they know what they want to do with it. Every game is sort of reinventing itself and throwing things at the wall to see what sticks, and like if in doubt, remake the first game, I guess. But I don't know, as we've talked about previously in terms of remakes and remasters and the sort of the purpose of these, like I don't know what the purpose of this is exactly. They already had that remaster in the Master Chief Collection a few years ago, and like the original game, I mean, it may have dated a little bit by now, but I think that's partly what's lost in all of these remakes and like the pixel remasters and everything, is it kind of homogenizes these series and turns them all into the same, rather than letting us appreciate what was different about these games in their time.
Well, in terms of the last remake, which was on the Master Chief Collection, it's been out for a number of years now, it did actually let you play the original in the original format, and in a really cool way, they did it like simultaneously with the remaster, so you just press one button, it took like half a second, but it swapped you over, and you really got to see night and day how the visual improvements were made. So that was really impressive. And I know that some games like, I think maybe like the DuckTales Remastered also let you do that, if I'm not mistaken. So I think that's a format that works really, really well with remasters. In terms of Halo, this is just, as you said, a move to expand the market. Obviously, everyone who has access to an Xbox has already played Halo as much as they want to, maybe more than they want to. As a series, it's kind of lost its way a long time ago, so this isn't really going to do anything to inject new blood into it, but it will expand its reach, excusing the pun, into a slightly broader market, maybe some people that had never played it before. Maybe it'll reach some people, for instance, in other markets like in Asia, like Japan, where the Xbox is not a popular platform.
It is hard to imagine there's a huge number of people who've been sitting out there for 20 years. Oh, one day I'll play the original Halo game, and like, now's the time. But we'll see. news for reasons why I'm upset with Xbox, though, I've been looking for games to play on my play co-op with my daughter. And a recent guest of the show, Dennis, was talking about Castle Crashers. So I booted that up on my... on Xbox, the original Xbox Live version from the 360 all those years ago, backwards compatible. Apparently, you cannot play that couch co-op. You have to, the only option is, download a profile. You can't, just use a guest account. You have to have, a Microsoft account just to play couch co-op with that game, which is a little ridiculous, I think. So that was a failed experiment there. So, not playing that's Xbox.
Pretty frustrating. Yeah, I mean, I guess you'll have to buy it again, right? Mm. I mean, that's how Nintendo does it.
That game has also been remastered recently, so yeah, I'll keep an eye out on that.
There you go. You want to tell us about some more news?
Yeah, well, just a couple of quick updates from last episode. Firstly, we reviewed Phantasy Star 2, and I just wanted to give a quick update in that I had gotten to the point that you'd sort of hinted at. There's a big mid-game twist, a big story beat in that game, which I hit and was quite effective. Unfortunately, I then managed to soft lock myself into the boss battle as part of that. And that's something I've really struggled with. We haven't talked about in terms of these retro games is there's these sort of save states, which can be very helpful and a lot more flexible compared to the original save modes of these games. But it's not always clear. Like it's easy to accidentally misplace those save states or hit load instead of save. I found that even on the Nintendo Online, switching between save states and the in-game save slots, it's not clear. It, bouncing back and forth, you can't really mix and match those things. You've got to commit to one or the other, really. I've missed it a couple of games that have... it's not been clear what's been saved exactly, so I'm gonna have to be a lot more careful with that in the future, I think. For now, I mean, I was enjoying Phantasy Star 2. I think I'm gonna have to drop it. I think I'm gonna skip forward to the fourth game, which I've heard is the best in the series by reputation and is on Nintendo Online. So I'll probably jump to that next and double back to the previous games eventually at some point down the road.
Yeah, that's too bad about Phantasy Star 2. Were you perchance also doing the traditional saves in towns when you were
no, so I don't think I could have doubled back to that, unfortunately.
That's unfortunate, because in an emulator, if you had been doing that, you could always reset from save state, mm-hmm. which would take you to the traditional opening menu, at which point you would have been able to load your last save mm-hmm. from a town, which may have saved you in that case. For my case, I generally try and save as many states as possible. So, sometimes I've done 10, sometimes I've done 30 or 100 states, because they don't take a lot of space. And you raise another point, backing up those save files, those save states, so save files as well, is another matter, especially if you have multiple consoles, handhelds. I won't delve into that. It's a bit of a nightmare that I'm juggling, but I'll let you know when I've sort of figured that out.
Yeah, unfortunately, the vanilla software on the NBNIC, the interface isn't great because, to have multiple slots, you have to, manually select a different slot. You can't just have a list of, here's the save states. So it's a little fiddly. So normally I would. And I'm playing Final Fantasy Tactics, which is another game that many people learn a hard lesson there and keep multiple save files.
Definitely, yeah. I think the remaster allows you to sort of back away from certain boss battles. So that is a good thing.
Add one more further update from last week is that we spoke about the crowdfunding campaign for Monster Heart's Welcome to Drowned Lake. Unfortunately, that campaign has since been cancelled. I guess they weren't getting the support they'd hoped for there. To be clear, the game project hasn't been cancelled. It seems like they are sort of recalibrating and going to reboot that project in a slightly different format. They're going to get some kind of playable demo happening for next year, I believe. So keep an eye on that. There will be more of it, hopefully. And in a playable state to try.
Yeah, I would definitely like to get my hands on that. And maybe that'll go a long way towards convincing people to back or support this project.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is more of a... In the video game industry, more so than board games, is this more of an expectation that there'd be a game to try. I mean, early access games are generally how these things are done lately, rather than just backing the whole thing on Kickstarter.
Yeah, there's like 100 or 1,000 games coming out every month, so it's hard to catch that... that visibility. Okay, cool. A couple of new stories from me. This one just came to my attention today, so I don't know very much about it, but there is a new Star Trek game in town. And no, I'm not talking about that Voyager-themed FTL clone that's out there, although maybe I'll be talking about that in some time to come. No, this one is a just announced game called Star Trek Infection. This is a VR-based game, so I imagine you'll need a MetaQuest or something like that. And it features, the detail that caught my attention was a Defiant-class ship. I don't think it's the actual Defiant, so it might not have any DS9 crossover there. But it looks like some sort of first-person, as you would imagine, it being VR, a game where there's some horrific aspects to it, like there's some sort of evil corruption or disease infection, you might say, that's taking over some sort of space station or ship. There is a trailer out there right now, so I haven't even been able to finish that trailer. But if you're a Star Trek fan like me and you're curious, Star Trek games have been good and bad. It's just a legacy of those licensed games from way early on. There were a few good ones from Interplay back in the day. There were some terrible ones. There's been some mobile ones that have been good or bad. There was a adventure game, kind of Telltale style adventure game that a little while ago that I actually purchased.
I've heard that's good.
Gotten around. Yeah, I've heard it's good too. I haven't gotten around to playing that yet, but that seems kind of the most high profile. Until that recent Voyager-based one that I mentioned.
The demo that I sent to you? There's like the Fallout Shelter-style simulation?
No, I have been following that game for a little while now.
Is that a different one than the Voyager one you're talking about?
It is the same one. But it is basically, it's a Star Trek Voyager-themed.
Mm.
So their overall story of Voyager is ship from the local part of space gets sent off into a distant quadrant of space, and they're far away from home and they have to make their way back. Lost in space, essentially. 1990s style. And they do the same thing in video game form now, with the licensed art, licensed character, likenesses. There is no voice acting yet, but that might just be the demo. And the premise is cool. It seems a lot more like FTL than it does seem like any of those more interactive games. It's very light and menu based. So it's FTL in terms of the overall kind of space traversal and management. The side missions, the away missions and things like that are very, very rudimentary menu based things. And then there's a cool ship management aspect, which is like that Fallout Shelter.
Or UI like Oxygen Not Included, the sort of ant farm zoomed out side profile. Yeah.
That's right. But that aspect of it is not like the whole game.
Okay.
So it is multiple aspects. So it is slightly more ambitious than you might think. I'm cautiously optimistic about it, but I haven't played a ton. But if anyone is curious out there, there's a Steam demo for that as well.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm not familiar with the Voyager or DS9. I'm still catching up on TNG very slowly.
Yeah, Voyager is actually a really cool premise. Like, you know where it starts and you know where it ends.
Mm.
So how you get there is the challenge of this game.
Awesome. Cool. One new bit of news for me is that there's a new crowdfunding campaign called Gorn to Gaia. So I believe we previously spoke about this a little when we had the designer Quinn Brander on the show to talk about Hades. You and I actually playtested this game with him briefly, and I don't think we can necessarily give a strong impression of our thoughts in the game. I'm sure it changed quite a lot in the last couple of years. But just to say that it is like a big sort of story-heavy campaign, sort of almost roguelike aspects in this game. It describes itself as Hades meets Vampire Survivor, two sort of genres that we've been talking about a lot here. So lots to enjoy there. My memories of it did include this really strong system of basically these tactical battles, but over the course of the battle, you were getting these upgrades, like semi-random upgrades for particular weapons or armor. So you were sort of improvised tactical sort of improvements as you went over the course of this game and the campaign. So take a look at that. It's on GameFound right now. The other strong bit I remember, it was it also had a lot of like story elements in the town building aspects, and quite a strong sense of the writing and the world building. That is still here, obviously, and they've added a dating sim expansion to further flesh that out, if that's what something you're looking for.
Right, and we should emphasize that this is a tabletop game, if some of that is sounding more video game style. It is a tabletop game. Mm. Quinn Brander, like we had on our guest, he is the designer of Rebuilding Seattle, is that the name?
Yeah, and they rebuilt another city, Rebuilding Chicago, I think? Yeah.
I think so. I don't know if that second game is out yet. But yeah, he's a really cool local designer here.
Not local anymore, he moved to Finland and I'm so jealous.
When we interacted with him, he was a local. And yeah, I thought there were elements that were really cool about that game. Really promising, let's just say. So I'm excited about Gone to Gaia as well.
Awesome. Okay, any more news from you?
Yeah, one last quick news story from me. I mentioned handheld games the other day, handheld platforms. I want to just spread some news about a new app for Android-based handhelds, like we have here. We have my Retroid Pocket 5. But this app will also work for any other Android-based device, such as a phone or tablet. So this might help you if you already have one of those such devices at home. So this app is called Game Native, and it's a free app. And what it does, it's a sort of a translation layer that lets you play Steam games on an Android device. Yeah. So why would you do that if you also had something like a Steam Deck, or in my case, a Lenovo Legion Go? Well, you don't have to do it at all, but or let alone a laptop. But here's a scenario for you, sort of like what happened when my last vacation during the summertime. I spent a month in Japan. I didn't have a lot of room to carry stuff, especially while I was in a car trip across the country. So I just had my backpack and just a tablet. And if you have just that, well, maybe you want to play some more lightweight Steam games, some more indie games that you've been meaning to get to, or some retro RPGs or something that's not too taxing, but you still wanted to try out. Well, this will let you do that. So that's Game Native, and basically it's free. And you just have to scan your, well, you can log in any way you want to Steam, but there's the two-factor authentication method, which I use, certainly, and that's pretty secure because you can't fake that, right? You need the two-factor authentication. They can't steal your password, per se, because you're not providing them with one. So if you enable it right, you have to configure some settings. So this is not plug-and-play. This is for kind of nerds like me that are happy to play with settings and things like that. But if you set it up right, then you can get some of your more lightweight PC games running on an Android-based device. And a lot of those tablets, you can just Bluetooth a controller to it, put it on your airplane tray table, and you'll be playing some of those PC games that you've been meaning to play without even having to have a PC with you. So that's Game Native. I think there is a competing product or something that does something similar called Game Hub, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. And that one is backed by hardware accessory maker GameSir. But there was a little bit of online buzz about that, maybe doing some dodgy stuff with like IP and licensing, and maybe even some security issues. Like they were gathering a lot of online telemetry that was unnecessary. Right. And a Game Native, I think, is a little bit less dodgy than that. So try at your own peril, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm definitely not game enough to try these until everyone sort of noodled out with them and made sure that they're by the by, and no thing to be concerned about security-wise there. So yeah, it sounds like another option if you're willing to tinker and try and experiment a bit. Sorry, this cat is really full of it tonight.
Just our third chair at the podcast. Yeah, definitely don't expect this to run your hotshot games. You're not going to be playing Cyberpunk 2077 on your Android tablet or phone, but definitely lightweight games. I was just showing, I think, 20 minutes to Dawn, which is really bite-sized. I figure if the game file size is under the RAM limit, then it'll probably just run just fine.
A ball pit that I talked about last episode, fairly low input game, I guess it would probably work pretty well.
There you go. All right, that's it for me for news. Shall we move on to the main course?
I guess so. Alrighty, main course. Should I start us off today?
Please.
Okay. So lately I've been in the mood for some word games, and I've never been a huge fan of word games, or more to say, I've never been very good at word games. I've, you know, stomped by my grandmother at Scrabble one too many times, I guess. But I've recently, you know, started to feel a little bit self-conscious about, you know, vocabulary and maybe leaning on the same words too many times, and started to explore some word games that are out there, messing with some crosswords and whatnot, board games, digital games, and that like. So one I reached for, especially, you know, in Halloween season, and I grabbed Cryptmaster. So this is a video game from Paul Hart and Lee Williams. So just the two guys as far as I know, but published by Akupara Games, released on May 9th, 2024. So, I mean, to look at that, this is basically a first-person dungeon adventure game in the line of Wizardry or Fantasy Star One, I guess. There was a series I was playing on my Switch last year that was also like mapping out a dungeon. But basically, it's a long
Etrian Odyssey.
That's the one. Yeah, there's a long genre history here. The trick here is that you're largely interacting with the world by typing. There's a sort of latent subgenre of typing games. I know Typing of the Dead is a big one I've heard a lot of love for. I spoke about Noise One, a very indie game I really enjoyed last year. Not something I've ever been particularly drawn to either. I mean, I know typing games are distinctly different from word games. There's definitely a bit of a crossover here, though. So, I mean, basically the broad premise here is you're playing as these four undead heroes. You've woken up in the catacombs by this necromancer, the eponymous Cryptmaster, and he's sort of controlling you by some method and encouraging you to go to the surface. What his motivations are remain unclear, but you're trying to, it's basically subversion where you're ascending out of the dungeon and trying to get back to the real world, essentially. And you are these zombies who can't really communicate but can just type words onto the screen. And it really does, you're interacting with this world in a lot of different verbs. Basically, because you move with the keyboard, but other than that, everything else you have to type, whether it's, you know, to buy something with a merchant or just to accept or reject an offer, you have to type yes or no for every little thing. So quite involved there. The art style you'll immediately notice is very monochrome, essentially. It's all in black and white, reminiscent of like a lot of the early D&D monster manuals, or like Fighting Fantasy, I believe, was another big influence there. So very retro. I mean, I've been reading through the manual for Mothership, which also does that sort of very monochrome classic illustration style. So before I get any deeper, Mark, I believe you've played a little bit of this.
A little bit is right. I played, I knew you were covering this, and I had seen it before, so it was already downloaded on my system. I played 10 minutes of this exactly before we started recording. It's very fresh in my mind. And I'll say that this game has a very unique look. It's entirely or like 95% black and white, which is very stark, but cool. Like there's a little bit of texture work in there. So visually, it's quite nice. And the Crypt Keeper, the titular Crypt Keeper, has a very distinctive presentation. I forget the old actor who had
Vincent
that,
Price.
Vincent, yeah. Yeah. It's doing a very Vincent Price kind of routine of melodramatic voice performance. And that is, you know, just fits in perfectly with the overall theme. And it has a little bit of humor as well. So if you were expecting this to be frightening or gore-filled, so far it hasn't been for me. And there's a few jokes in there.
It's very British sense of humor, very dry wit, bone dry, some might say. But it's it is frequently funny. The writing is humorous, but not trying too hard, I found. The voice performances are all pretty strong too. You wouldn't have seen, but one of the early areas is filled with these sort of rat kobolds who all inexplicably have Australian accents for some reason, which is just funny, right? So, I mean, Mark, have you played many word games outside of this? Is that something that you're generally into?
I think I played probably 15 minutes of Typing of the Dead. And, like, there were old typing games I probably played on the Apple II or something like that back in the day. But, no, I am kind of, like, curious about them. But there's a little stigma that, like, edutainment games have sort of left in my mind. Because I definitely grew up in the era of the computer lab edutainment titles.
There was the whole brain training trend a decade or two ago that I don't know how much stock I put into that, whether it's how useful that is.
Yeah, all bunk.
It's got to be, there's got to be some value to, like, training, like, flexing those muscles at least and practicing, finding an outlet to practice words, I guess, and thinking about them, perhaps. But broadly, I think there's two sort of main subgenres to these word games. One being you have to try and think of a very specific word, and there'll be various clues in order for you to try and guess that word. Or there's the here's a bunch of letters, try to make a word with that. This game, Cryptmaster, is very much in the former. So the way in which you're... There's a lot of different formats of word puzzles within this game. So basically, the main way you're interacting with it is that each of these four characters you have, these four heroes of different classes, essentially, they have abilities, but they're dead. They've forgotten all of their abilities, and so you have to try and remember them. And so each one at a time, they will have a blank word below their profile. It will show you how many letters it is. And you can try and guess that. I mean, you can sit there at the start of the game and guess them all if you really want to brute force it. But the large focus is trying to find clues. So whenever you fight a monster, when you loot their name and basically take the letters from their name, and if those letters appear anywhere in these words, it'll fill them in. Or there's some other puzzles and riddles you'll find along the way that you also, if you solve that, the answer to the riddle, any letters from that will also fill in. And so you're gradually filling out these abilities. Like the Joro the Barbarian, he might have an ability that's hit. That's a very simple one. So you can use that to attack monsters. Or Boots, which will push back monsters. And so they very quickly start layering on a lot of different types of abilities. Then they might heal each other or synergize with each other. It might be that one of the characters will boost one of the other characters' abilities. Like there's one who has an ability called Murder. Most of the characters will have a word that will boost the Murder ability. So you've got to, like, combo those in the right order. So there's a lot of synergy in back and forth in a way that's quite clever. It also very quickly gets overwhelming. Like, at the point that I'm in, each character has probably 8 to 10 abilities or, like, distinct words, and I can never remember half of them. By default, this game is in real time. Like, when you're fighting a monster, it is, like, turn-based. Like, in the sense that each character has a cooldown timer, but that timer is acting upon in real time. So if you just stand there, the monster is eventually going to attack you on a set timer. There is a turn-based mode that I've tried, experimented with, and it does slow things down quite a bit. The game recommends the real-time mode. It is, as I said, very overwhelming, though, when you're learning all these words and trying to memorize them. Maybe some people are just better suited for, like, that sort of form of memorization. Personally, I struggled a little bit with that.
Yeah, the combat was remarkably stressful, even though I only did the very first one. Sort of like, what is that, Legend of Grimrock or whatever?
Yeah.
First-person RPG. The movement is, it's a bit strange. It seems like it's not turn-based. The map movement doesn't seem to be turn-based either. It is for the player, but it's not for the monsters. Like, they seem to be moving independent of whether you move or not. And then, you know, I did, like, hit or something to initiate the combat. I slashed at the monster. And then, like, that was the only attack that I'd figured out. I figured out, like, hit and yell or something like that. And so I tried those both, and then the cooldown timer you mentioned came up, and I was like, I don't know what these other attacks are, because it hadn't come up yet. And it's remarkable how stressful it is to come up with even just 3 or 4-letter words. And, you know, you have a lot of restrictions, right? Like, these are all going to be verbs, pretty much, initially. So, like, you should be able to come up with those easily, but in the heat of the moment, I wasn't.
Yeah, and, like, most of these characters have, like, a very simple 3-letter word that will start them out, and then they get more complicated down the road as they get more involved, these abilities. And I think that's partly the thing for me, is just that the stress level is, like, just... Even for the relatively simple words, the stress throws me out to the point that I'll just rely on those simple 3-letter words over and over again. The game does have various motivations to basically prevent you from doing that. You'll very quickly start running into monsters where, oh, this one has a shield with a giant O on it. So it blocks any words with O's. Now you can't use boots anymore or soothe, for example. So it will sort of force you out of your comfort zone and force you to, like, try different synergies and experiment with other abilities that you wouldn't necessarily go to. So I do think that's quite clever in sort of coming up with these organic ways of forcing you to just not repeat the same strategy over and over again. But I think I'm at this point probably going to switch to the turn-based mode, so I can take my time and sort of explore through that. You can look through the list of their abilities and sort of think out the process a little more.
Yeah, and I hadn't played a PC-based game in a while. I mean, I play games on PC, but they're usually the ones where I just require... It's just turn-based, so I just require a mouse input. So that's very straightforward. Of course, I played FPS games on PCs in the past, though I typically prefer controller to play on console. But it was interesting to play an entirely keyboard-based game without a mouse.
Yeah.
It kind of, like, makes you... twists you around a little bit because, you know, I'm usually just fingers on WASD and ready to go. Where do I go with the mouse? But no, I don't think the mouse does anything in this game.
I don't think so, no. It is strangely immersive, even when you're just typing in hit, zap, stab. Like, that does bring you into the game on another level. And there are, a wider variety of verbs, as I said, that you're interacting with it with. One of the big elements of this game is to save the game, you have to go to these altars. But it's some goddess of light, she has altars. In order for you to save the game and heal yourself as zombies, you have to desecrate the altars. So, Mark, how would you like to desecrate this altar?
I can think of a 4-letter word pretty quickly.
And if you can think of it, the chances are the game has also thought of it and has added unique sound effects for those 4-letter words.
And there's voiceovers that will respond to all of your guesses saying, ah, yes, that word. Not what I would have done, but it's funny that they have predicted what these inputs would be.
Yeah, well, that's the big thing in this game. Like, throughout the story, like outside of combat, but talking to various characters throughout the story, you'll regularly be asked these questions. Like, oh, you'll be talking to a god, like, oh, what is it you want from me? And you'll be surprised just how many answers they have anticipated. If it's not the specific answer that they've guessed, they'll have at least thought through some of the sub-genres of answers that you might give. And most of the responses, even if they're not specifically related to that word you said, they'll still feel quite clever in how they sort of approach that. It's like, no one's ever asked me that before. It always feels very anticipatory in how they're responding to you. Even if it's not the exact word you said, they do it in quite a sort of clever sort of winking way that the game is always interacting with you back and forth.
You know what this game kind of brought me back to is text-based adventure games, because in a lot of those, before you had real-time UI of any kind, you didn't even have a graphical interface of any kind. You just had word scrolls on the screen, and the only inputs were just typing. And a lot of the times, you're just typing blindly, and of course, those games had to have predicted the sort of inputs or pre-programmed the sort of inputs, so it might have been like, hit rat, and then it would say, hit rat with what? And then you would have to type, okay, that didn't work, hit rat with book. And hit rat with book, it would just parse the language into commands that it understood, and there'd be synonyms like strike for hit or whack or things like that. So a text-based parser, you know, is very much the same technology or conceptually what they're doing here.
Yeah, those games can always draw you out of it, though. Whenever you type something in and just gives you a null result, like, don't recognize that word, try again, try again. Like, that can always... that's a big friction point with these games. Whereas this, even when you doesn't recognize a specific word, it will play with that in some funny ways, I think, and that sort of keeps the momentum going rather than taking you out of the game.
It's based on the engine of the game. Mm. They had the technology even during text-based parser times to interpret the words in any way possible. They could make jokes on the side, even if you made a wrong choice about, like, I wouldn't do that with a book. there's it's all up to the creativity of the programmers to come up with, you know, responses to the potential inputs that you would make.
Yeah, I mean, and to be clear, this is fully voice acted. So if the writers have thought of a specific response, they've also voiced it out. And they've done a lot of that. Like, this... it's quoted something like 4,000 different responses and voice lines in this that they've anticipated the different words. So I think they have done a really good job of that broadly. That you generally will have the specific responses will happen enough to feel quite satisfying when it does fire off.
And this isn't to do with voice acting, but there is a more modern example of kind of a text-based parser game is a little one called Scribblenauts.
Mm.
So that game was, I guess, like 2000s, fairly
popular. Is that on DS, I think?
It definitely was on DS, yeah. But it was on other platforms as well. And that game was graphical, and it had a little character, but it had you typing in or drawing in words, and then if it had a match, then it would create an object in that game world that you can interact with, like a wand or a sword or
type in Godzilla and Superman and see them fight.
Right. Yeah, so those games always delight me in what creativity that the developers can show, because it's not just like technical at that point, it's like creative, and the creative right at the root of the word is like, what just ideas can you come up with?
And when you like suggest something and the designers have a specific answer to that, it really creates a sense of conversation. Like, we're on the same page here, right? So one other thing I wanted to run through was that these other sort of puzzles that you come across in this game is that you regularly find these chests, and the Crypt Master will open it up and, ooh, what do we have here? And you basically play this game of sort of 20 questions. I mean, it's not just yes or no answers. You have to ask him to interact with the object in a particular way, like look at the item or lick the item, listen to it. Yeah, and right. He'll give you a rough, fairly vague answer, but you can start to piece those together. And if you get that right, again, those letters will sort of fill in your sort of blocks at the bottom there. So those are quite fun. There's also these skull riddles that will vary from the sort of your traditional logic puzzles, like your, what has four legs in the morning, two legs two in the day, and three, yeah, you know, we all know the answer to that one. The etymology responses with like playing with the words, playing with letters in the words. So some are just outright jokes or puns. One was actually a math problem. So there's a pretty wide variety of sort of puzzles there. The game does have a sort of this clue system. If you just give up and leave and come back, it'll have filled in one of the letters. The Crypt Master will also just ask you, do you want me to just give you the answer here? Like, I could stare at this for 20 minutes and try and figure it out and, like, try... There's no stakes to getting a wrong answer. You can try any number of words you want and brute force it, or you can just give up and he'll give it to you. You get, like... You only get half of the rewards, I believe, in terms of the currency. But, to be honest, there's so much else going on in this game, I never felt bad for just... like taking the answer, like and just enjoying the response, because it's always usually like witty in some fashion, and he'll have some commentary on it, and just keep the momentum of the game going forward rather than just staring at the screen for half an hour, sort of banging my head on the keyboard. So I appreciated that. There are lots of options there if you do really want to lean into these riddles and puzzles, but if you just want to have a more approachable, accessible time, like there's lots of accessibility options there too.
Yeah, it sounds like a game that's not really about winning, per se.
Mm.
And a lot of word games are, and a lot of just video games are. But this game, sort of like that Scribblenauts example, is a game about like experiencing and interacting and sort of delighting at the kind of fun little sneaky puzzles that they've created for you. Fun
interactions. Yeah, because, I mean, the combat is pretty, like, unimportant in the grand scheme of things. Like, there's not really any boss fights or anything. All the story is just, like, fetch quests and interacting with characters in ways that are completely unrelated to you, to the sort of combat abilities you're getting. So you could just avoid all the enemies and not engage in the combat at all, other than the fun of figuring out these names and trying new abilities and answering the riddles. Like, you're just enjoying these sort of mini games for the fun of it, rather than just the grinding out to see number go up.
Very cool. Yeah, it's sounds like a promising game worth playing a bit more of, at very least.
Yeah, it's not without its frustrations. Like, the map design is a little tricky, and I've led to believe that you'll probably end the game with, like, a fraction of the abilities unlocked unless you're, like, grinding things out. So the pacing is probably not all the way polished off, but I'm having a blast so far. So I think I'm, like, halfway through the game, probably. But the writing is top-notch, and regardless of how you feel about word games and how clever you are, there's something to be enjoyed here.
Yeah, a real cool experience. Okay, so for my main course, I'm going to be covering a bunch of smaller courses. So this is a kind of tapas meal, if you want to call it that. And Steam is having their, what is it? Is it Next Fest, or it's some sort of demo fest?
It's Next Fest, but they're having, it feels like there's one of those every 2 months now, so I can't keep up with it.
Exactly. I don't know when it began and when it ends. Anyways, it's going on recently, so I played a few demos, and here's my thoughts on them. The following demos, if we have time, we'll talk about all three of them. I played for between, like, 20 minutes and an hour of each, so your mileage may vary. And also, these are early versions of the games in many cases, so some of the things I talk about might change when you eventually try them out, if you eventually try them out. First title I'm going to talk about is called Hand of Hexes. This is, ostensibly, it is a tower defense game, but it's got some deck building elements to it, because, of course, every game is a deck builder now. And unlike the previous game, Crypt Master, Hand of Hexes is entirely language independent. There's no words. I don't think I saw any words. certainly in the UI that I played with. So it's got iconography, like, you know, arrows and X's and skulls and things like hearts and stuff like that for all the various things. And this was a little bit frustrating a bit during the tutorial, because it's a new game to me. Because this game has no words, they've taken to the nth degree. It doesn't even have any instructions, at least not any written ones.
No tutorial? Okay.
There is a tutorial, but they don't tell you anything. They just point you at stuff. So the way that the game is laid out is it's very much like a over-the-top traditional tower defense game, but it's grid-based. So it's entirely based on squares as opposed to a more kind of organic flow. And there's a kind of a monster generator, and then there's the monster tower. And the monster tower, or whatever your the goal that whatever you're defending, is a cat wizard. So another kind of plus to this game is that you're playing a kind of cutesy cat wizard. Not anthropomorphic, by the way, just like standard old just cat. So that's kind of awesome. And the bad guys are a range of cute, cartoony, hand-drawn monsters.
Looks
sort of
papercraft style.
Very much hand-drawn, kind of doodled. Like, the first monsters the enemies that you get attacked by are plague doctors, and then there's knights, and then there's who I call the KKK healers, who are these kind of guys wearing kind of pointy hat ghost outfits, but they heal the guys around them. So the cool aspect of this game is that the path that they take is not necessarily prescribed. They're going to take like a kind of an optimal path between the start and end. There's even a little preview, and it shows you which path it'll take. But the towers that you drop can stop them, can become barriers. So you can actually create the route that they'll follow. They can't go through, and you're also not allowed to put down a tower if it blocks all the paths forward. So you have to enable at least one valid path forward, but if you somehow do, then, you know, anywhere you place stuff is valid. So you gain a certain amount of resources generates from zero, and it generates every 30 seconds or something like that in real time. So you just can't spam the buttons even when you're dealt a hand of cards. And you have to spend a certain amount of currency to even draw a new hand of cards. So there's a little bit of timing. There's a little bit of strategy to it for an RTS that's card-based. That's kind of cool, I thought. The towers, the type of attacks are mostly just different directions on an arrow. Hmm. Some just go left, some go down, some go at a diagonals, and some attack a perimeter, kind of an area around the tower. So nothing too outstanding there. But this game is not really innovating in great ways. What it's doing is it's kind of like charmingly, very in an understated way, bringing some of these tried and true mechanisms together and creating a fairly kind of casual, lightweight blend of these various features. So I mostly enjoyed what I played. I wasn't blown away. I'm not beating down the door to play this, but I will just come right out and say that I did wishlist this game. And I don't know how much this game costs, so your mileage may vary as well. So, you know, the thing about this game is that this game is more about, as opposed to a real-time game where you can play this multiple times over, I think this is essentially like a puzzle. Like, I think there will be an optimal solution for each map. And some of these maps are devious, by the way, but I think there is going to be an ultimate solution. So once you figure that out for map 1A, there's really no point in playing that again. So if you're okay with that, if you like puzzle games with a slight real-time action-y element to it, go ahead and check this one out. But I don't think this is going to be your forever roguelite like Slay the Spire or something like that. I think it'll have a beginning and an end, and that's cool.
Hmm. Yeah, I've never had a huge love of tower defense games, but I do prefer that sort of puzzly aspect rather than the min-maxing optimization of the sort of synergies and everything. So if it's more of like a pathing puzzle, I can definitely see some appealing in that.
Yeah, this is exactly that. Some of the maps were like so devious that they they canceled out a lot of the tricks that you'd learned from previous maps, because there would be like a path that the characters would follow and these little nooks that the towers could go in. But the towers you've been given so far don't point in a direction that would actually make use of that. So you have to be really clever in how you place things. It is keeping you guessing every map, let's just say. Awesome. So I think that's a cool thing. All right. So once again, that was Hand of Hexes Steam demo available now. I'll talk about my next game is another kind of deck builder. This time it's called Glintland. This is a slightly different type of strategy game. It is automation / factory building deck builder. It's got a light fantasy theme, but the theme doesn't really matter. It is kind of like this isometric layout, so not exactly like Factorio, certainly not like Satisfactory. You can kind of think of this as a kind of a cross between Factorio and Carcassonne.
I was thinking Carcassonne or like Dorf Romantic instead of that tile laying.
So like Carcassonne, it is square-based tiles, and, you know, as you would imagine, it has four sides, and you have resource generators that will shoot resources out one of the directions. Of course, you can freely rotate where an item goes, and you might have to put one of those resource generators on a mountain, for instance, if you want to gain ore, or you have to put it on a copse of trees if you want to generate lumber and things like that. And there's, as you might imagine in other factory games, there's fabricators. So you might take the wood, you might chop them into logs, and then you take the logs and you put them into planks, etc., etc. And you route things together with these Carcassonne style conveyor belts. And Bob's your uncle, then you've created a harp or whatever. So now here's the thing is there's kind of two kinds of factory automation games in my mind, and ones that are more open-ended and some that are more puzzly. And this one definitely leans on the more puzzle side. This is based on short levels. Basically, you're going to be like, hey, the wizard wants you to make 50 harps. I don't know why he wants 50 harps, but you need to deliver 50 harps. Or the dwarf wants 37 axes. I don't know, whatever. That's a good one. So you need wood and stone and crystals. And you have all the parts to make them, and you put them together and you make them. But it is not inspiring. It is not exciting. Mm. And the theme seems entirely pasted on. So the theme is not interesting enough to make me feel like it's worth being there. And the exercise is not exciting enough to justify the time that I spent on it. Now, you might be saying, well, Mark, you like games like Satisfactory, and you've put, like, you know, hundreds of hours into those games. Well, the thing about those games is that they do have larger goals. So they might have a goal like collect 500 units of X, Y, and Z, and that sounds really boring. But it gives you intermediary goals, and it gives you creative freedom before you reach that end step. It doesn't tell you exactly how to do it. Also, you have to kind of fight with the terrain of the world to deal with that. This game doesn't do that. And furthermore, once you've reached that goal, that tier of development, all the things you built, you can build upon. You can build further upon. So you feel you're rewarded by investing your time, and you are become proud of what you built. And in this game, all of that is wiped away.
You're starting again every mission. Level is done. Right? Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. It's like, you've delivered your 40 harps, now let's destroy everything you built so far. So it feels quite unfulfilling that way. So this game is sort of boring. The theme is pasted on, and I felt unfulfilled. So this, long story short, is not a game that I added to a wish list. So that's Glint Lands, an automation factory deck builder. Okay, I think we have time. So why don't I quickly talk about the third game that sure. I played. A demo that I played. And this one seemed like the most kind of robust of the demos that I played, so it's the reason why I'm speaking about it last. This game is called Whisker Wood. Whisker, like cat whiskers. I mentioned cats, there's a reason why. Is because there are cats in this game. So this game takes place in a fantasy world, and you're doing fantasy colonialism and fantasy resource extraction. So you're doing that at the behest of the cat empire, or I don't know what they're called, but they're represented by
the
cats.
The Marquis of Cats.
Yes. And you, or I don't know, the people that work for you, you're the governor, I suppose, are all mice. So there's some social commentary built in there. So I don't love the concept of colonialism and resource extraction, but the mechanisms are still pretty fun. You know, you and we played that Against the Storm game a little while ago, right? That had animals in it.
And there's also, I think it's called Timberborn. It's a town building game about beavers.
Beavers, that's right.
Yeah, it's definitely big right now. And I saw this game, I was considering trying the demo. But the thing to me, though, is it didn't look particularly mousy. Like, the aesthetic and everything looked like just any other like colonial town building game. It didn't look particularly distinct in that sense.
It does a lot. In that sense, the sort of the animal theming, I think they're doing it to make it cutesy, to cover over the fact that it's colonialism and it's resource extraction. And, you know, those topics are not very fun and happy. It's the reason why that game Root is so popular as it is, because if it featured sweaty old dudes and halberds and, you know, whatever, suits of armor, that probably wouldn't have sold as well as cute mice and cats.
Mm.
So this game is doing exactly that. In terms of gameplay, it is voxel-based, so the world is voxel-based, but the characters are, you know, cute and nicely illustrated. I think they're 3D, they're nicely animated, they're very cute as they move along the terrain, and it kind of looks like a cross between, like, Age of Empires and Minecraft. And I actually really like the aesthetic of it. It's kind of traditional, but it works, in my opinion. Unlike a lot of RTS games that I played recently, like, everything is really, like, legible. Like, it's really clear what's going on. I've said in the past that some sci-fi style RTS games don't make a lot of sense in terms of the technologies and the UI and the naming of things. Buildings, but in this game, you know what a lumber mill does, you know what a farm does, you know what housing is, so all of that stuff totally makes sense. So this game, there is no tutorial for this game, unlike the one of the examples I mentioned before. So if you don't already enjoy the RTS genre, you're kind of going to be lost for this. That said, I think it's overall a pretty gentle introduction, but yeah, be prepared. There's a lot of kind of concepts that it builds upon some of those games that I previously mentioned. Okay, so the cool loop of this game is that, thematically it's not cool, but basically you are a governor of this colony, they drop you off on this island, and you have to build it up. You have to extract the resources, and every few days you have to pay taxes. Mm. Just like yield the new colonies of England did in North America. And they loved paying taxes, just so you know, a historical fact. So they have to pay taxes to the home country, to the cats. So the cats say, we need this much wood, this much berries, and that sort of stuff. And the cool aspect of this is that that gives you a constraint and it gives you a goal. So not only have to build up efficiently, you have to build up a certain amount and be able to survive beyond that point. And the cool aspect of it is that you can under-deliver slightly. If you totally fail, you fail. But you can slightly under-deliver and get unfavorable reviews, but you can also over-deliver. Mm. If you're super efficient, you basically get glowing marks, get A+, and they give you some extra rewards. It's like, hey, governor, you're doing great on this fantasy island, so we'll give you a really nice chair to make your experience that much more enjoyable. And another cool aspect of this is that there are these kind of real-time events. So there'll be these like missions that pop up, and a lot of them, I think most of them, are optionals. So they'll be like, gain 2 extra workers and do this sort of thing and we'll give you 2 extra workers, or do this sort of smaller goal and we'll give you these type of resources. And those are cool because it mixes things up, keeps you on your toes.
Mark our goals, yeah, keep you invested and motivated.
Yeah, a lot of these RTS games can be quite repetitive and a little bit boring if you feel like you've done everything before. And these events keep you on your toes, certainly.
Yeah, especially if it's something you're already going to be doing anyway, then the goals feel pretty redundant. But if it sort of forces you to try something different.
Right. One of those goals might be too easy because you've just already fulfilled it. And one of those goals would be too hard because you haven't unlocked that technology yet. But one of the aspects of it was quite cool. It was like pirates attack you because you're on an island and you got this prosperous colony going. Everything's looking great, except this pirate ship comes and they give you a choice. They say, give us this amount of resources and we'll let you live. Or you can refuse them. And because I was feeling, feisty? A little feisty at that day, I said, no, heck no, pirates, I refuse. So what they did was they sent their cannons flying from their ships. And those cannons flew and they destroyed half my buildings and killed some of my lovely mice. So that's quite drastic, right? Called bluff. But also, what a cool mechanism. Like, that's real consequences for being able to deliver or not. Like, what is it going to be? Or maybe you want to allow that to give you an extra challenge. Kind of like how you would let the natural disaster or Godzilla attack your city in SimCity back in the day.
And so many times you'll be given this choice, and it just comes down to numbers. Do you pay the 3 wood to ignore the cost, or do you pay 5 gold to do this other thing? Like, it's just topping numbers back and forth.
Yeah, this game is kind of the opposite of that, because they've done some really nice touches. You mentioned Oxygen Not Included when we were talking about the 2D, I think we were talking about the Voyager game before. But this game is like Oxygen Not Included in the way that all of the people you bring to your island, all the mice that you bring to your island, have names, they have personalities, and they have sort of genetic tweaks. So this one's, say, they are a loner, but they're swift. So they don't like to be assigned to work with people, but they work really fast. And these other ones are like monarchist. So like, this is not something that I've encountered yet, but I guess like, maybe there's going to be some kind of political aspect to the game at a later point. So I don't know where I sit on the, I know where I personally sit, but I don't know where my character sits on the monarchy pro or anti stage yet. So I don't know.
I know Against the Storm played with something similar, but it very quickly gets to the point where it's just there's too many units to sort of realistically keep track and optimize those.
Yeah, and like Oxygen Not Included, there are reasons where you might not want to accept all of the workers that they're sending to you, because you have to house those workers and you have to feed those workers. So the cost it takes, the resources it takes to maintain them might not be worth the output gains that you gain from them. So these are real interesting choices, real interesting personalities. You feel bad if that character you really like is the one of them that got killed by the pirates' cannons. So this game, I thought, thematically enjoyable, mechanically really fun, really engaging, just kind of like right up my alley. Really solid, if unimaginative, gameplay. But if you've been wanting to play a game like this, I don't think you could do, you can do much better than this game. I found it quite addicting and challenging. So I wishlisted this game. It is called Whiskerwood. Steam demo available now.
Excellent. I have been in the mood for one of those games. I've been thinking about like the Anno series and things like that, which are very much just your dusty old Euro. Yeah. I wasn't sure how this approached that. So if it's a little more nuanced, perhaps I'll take another look.
Yeah, those RTS games about colonization and resource extraction are a little bit dodgy because those are not universally loved concepts like maybe they were in the past, if they ever were. I think the Anno series has been doing some interesting things, mixing up, like they're going to different time periods in time that are not necessarily so universally despised. You know, they're going all up and down history, sometimes even going into the future, space colonization and things like that.
So. What's the thing? So many times having animals in your game instead of people or going to space is just an excuse to play with these themes without really addressing these themes and critiquing them. Whereas something like Anno, actually, as far as I know, does actually get into some of those sort of commentary on these sort of class structures.
That style of game, there's something that's inexplicably enjoyable about managing things and optimizing them. Well, I find them fun anyway, so this game was a good example of that.
Excellent. Okay. I didn't see much in terms of demos. I tried a few, but I had to really dig to any that weren't like just AI slop or looks pretty low effort. And most of the few I did try didn't really leave much of an impression. There were one or two I wanted to talk about, but maybe I'll save for another episode.
Cool. Yeah. I don't play a lot of gameplay demos. I usually just wait for kind of the creme de la creme to crop up. But I think you did point out that I've been playing a lot of retro games of late. So I wanted to rectify that and play some newer ones. And I'm giving the Voyager game a little bit more time. So maybe I'll have a deeper review or deeper preview of that in a week or so.
Awesome. Looking forward to that. Okay.
Shall we talk some dessert?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. Would you like to go first?
Sure, why not? So this is one I've been wanting to talk about for a little while, but haven't ever found the right time. But basically, my wife was away this last weekend, and so once the kid was in bed, I sat down to enjoy one of my favorite horror films, and that is House. This is the 1977 film by Nobuhiko Obayashi, not to be confused with the American film House from the 80s, I think it was, that was like a Lovecraftian monster slasher film. But this is, basically a Japanese film from the 70s. It's marketed as something of a children's film. Apparently it didn't do particularly well in its expected demographic, but was just a wild hit with children back in Japan when it first released. Mark, have you seen House before I get into this?
No, I haven't, but I'm interested. Please.
Yeah, basically it's a haunted house film. Seven young schoolgirls go to a haunted house owned by one of their aunts, basically. And things turn strange, with a whole bunch of weird sort of supernatural things going on. It's clearly tied to the Bakuniko sort of ghost cat folklore that I talked about a little bit previously, but playing with a lot of other wacky things here. The thing is, this movie starts out this really saccharine sweet that you would not think is a horror movie at all. The music is all this weird sort of bubblegum pop, and the girls are just all sort of just smiling and silly, and everything's happy and almost too happy in the sense that it's like discordance. Like the music starts to sort of layer over in sort of very funny ways that can be a little disconcerting, and things gradually ramp up once they get to this haunted house. But even then, it's not really scary. Nothing in this film is ever really like horror. It's a lot of it's almost funny, even though it is like quite graphic, and the girls are like being killed off ostensibly. The graphics and the presentation are all very sort of silly and whimsical, but it's the subtext and the themes remain in terms of some of these sort of darker undertones. It's just a wild movie in terms of, you know, I think it's the most cartoonish live action film I've ever seen. It's a lot of experimentation and just weird art house experimental film work. The director is obviously having so much fun and just really like making the medium of film just work in so many unique ways that you wouldn't see in any other. So it's just a love of the genre here. It's fascinating to see some of these like weird like animated cutaways and weird sort of overlays and matte paintings and everything. It's quite strange. And even like it's very clearly all on a soundstage, but in this way that it's not that the movie very obviously isn't trying to look realistic, but it almost goes so far in the other direction as to look unreal or hyper real in this really like uncanny, you know, upsetting way. So it's extremely manic and just absurd fun, I think, for a horror film. You're never going to be bored. It's just, you'll always be surprised by what's happening in this film.
Sounds like grade school battle royale.
Something like that. But the thing is, there's very little logic in this film because so much of it is from the director's daughter. Like his daughter was 10 at the time, and she basically came up with a lot of the weird horror elements that just are things only a child could come up with that no adult would be scared of, like someone being eaten by a piano or a floating head coming out of the well to attack them, or being stuck in a clock, and a lot of inexplicable mundane things that you wouldn't think to be scared of, but children will just latch onto in sort of weird ways. And so it's all filtered through the lens of this sort of childlike fear / wonder.
Very cool. Yeah, I think that like Asian cinema is interesting. Japanese cinema is interesting, but you know, I'm sure others are as well. I don't have an extended experience beyond most Japanese stuff, but like, you know, there's some things like horror, like Junji Ito's stories, I've read a decent amount of, and there's some weird things that he seems scared of, right? Some of those stories almost seem like non sequiturs. It's like, really? That's the big bad evil?
Well, it's like
interesting.
His cat diary book about how horrific cats are. I mean, literally being attacked by one this entire episode.
It just made me think that maybe it's not just a little what little kids find scary. It's like with the kind of a different perspective on what's horrific.
Yeah, it's definitely a unique take. And one thing I was surprised by is, like, I was constantly thinking, the music in this film is really strange, because a lot of it is in English, for one thing, but it is a Japanese band. There's inexplicably an American in this Japanese band, but he's not singing. It's not a Japanese fellow singing in English. But I kept thinking, you know what, I'm getting a lot of Monkey Magic vibes here. And I wasn't sure if I was just being weirdly racist or anything, but sure enough, it is the same band who did the theme song for Monkey Magic. I'm not sure if that's something that you were exposed to, Mark.
No, is this some sort of like early anime that was translated into English?
It's actually a live-action Japanese series from 78 called Monkey. I can't remember the Japanese name. Mm-hmm. But, based on Journey to the West, a Chinese story, but there's a lot of Japanese takes on that story. So it was made in Japan in 78. Exactly. But then the BBC translated it, or like dubbed over it. And so even the original version was still like an English theme song, but it was dubbed over into English by the BBC, and so I saw it in Australia that way, basically. So it's, yeah, that's a strange one. I'll have to revisit that.
Yeah, that reminds me of, like, 1970s live-action Japanese Spider-Man.
Mm.
We'll talk about that sometime. Okay, are you good for house?
Yes, go ahead.
All right. My bit of dessert is going to be... I'll do it really quick because it's only going to really be relative mostly to people here in Vancouver. I went to the Vancouver Art Gallery today. I'm going to talk about some of the exhibits that I saw. And maybe it'll be useful because some of these pieces could go on the road. And there are some international artists here as well. Okay, so the first piece you can only see here is a built-in installation by Jim Lambie. It's called Zobop Color Chrome. This is a colorful pop art installation. You can see on the Vancouver Art Gallery website right now, but, you know, just to be there in person, it's a sight to behold. Yeah, it's in the main atrium, and it's essentially covering the entire atrium floor and the kind of winding staircases that go around up to the second floor and the second tier veranda there. And it just, like, really, really stands out, kind of like, as you might imagine. It's colorful, it's poppy, everyone was just, like, pulling out their phones, Instagram, kind of very, it's art in the Instagram era. Everyone really seemed to enjoy it, and it's quite cool, especially things, because I think it's entirely made out of duct tape. Huh. It's basically, like, really, really finely cut and laid, intricately laid out pattern work of duct tape.
Like different colored duct tape?
Yeah, okay. Like every neon duct tape and even like metallic silver. So really, really striking.
Hmm.
That was a cool piece. And that was just one. The main one we wanted to see was by an artist called Otani Workshop. A Japanese artist, but an artist in residence. I think they were commissioned to produce this exhibit for the Vancouver Art Gallery. And interestingly enough, many of the pieces that were on display were created here in Canada with local materials and local inspiration. Basically, I forget the name of it, but there's a artist in residence house that's used for a lot of movie filming and things like that. It's on Deer Lake Park, Lake. And it's, you'll notice, it if you see it. And basically, Mr. Otani was invited to live here for a while, I imagine, and create some of these pottery pieces. So the exhibit is mostly pottery with a little bit of painting as well. And I think that this exhibit is particularly great for fans of, for kids. It's very like cute creations, characters, in the both the pottery and the painting subjects. And there's a lot of kids, there's a lot of the artists drawing themselves as a kid. If you like other Japanese pop art illustrators like Yoshitomo Nara or Takashi Murakami, I think this will be like right up your alley. Really, really impactful stuff, but just kind of colorful, delightful, and kind of like childlike in its interpretation. So his work mixed really, really kind of like, how did he do that sort of pottery work? These like giant pieces that were clearly had to be fired in, you know, very like intricate manner. And there were like cracks in some of the pieces. And these are new pieces, right? But some of the cracks were filled in with that gold fill, the kintsugi style.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So like that was really cool to see. It just, I don't know, like just really powerful stuff. And it felt Japanese, but it also felt very much of here. So, very unique exhibit.
Fusion art.
Yeah. The next wing, there was pretty much like the other half of the primary wing was another pottery exhibit. It was the John David Lawrence collection. And this is a range of like over 100 pieces, all from various BC potters. This was mostly of the 20th century. There wasn't a lot of like brand new stuff, but obviously this is kind of like a lifetime collection. And it was really impressive work. It's a little bit more subdued, a lot less poppy than the Otani Workshop one. But each piece is kind of like a world in itself. Like you can appreciate it in its own right. There was a bunch of different styles on display. And what was also interesting is there's a lot of like practical pieces. Like there's plates, pitchers, vases, but there's beauty in all of them. So that was well worth seeing as well. And we didn't get to see all of it, but we ended up buying ourselves a yearly membership because the local BC resident price was like $29. The non-BC resident price was $36. I think it's free for First Nations individuals, which is very cool, to parents and to children. What do they call it? Caregivers.
Mm.
So like grandparents, I guess, or whatever, and children. And the annual membership was only like $58. So like basically two visits. So we thought it was worthwhile. And because kids are free, we can bring our kids. So we'll be coming back for this one. The exhibit was called Enemy Alien. It's featuring a photographer called Tamio Wakayama, who grew up locally here in New Westminster and then was interned during World War II in his youth, being a Japanese Canadian. And after the war, remigrated to, I forget the community, I think it's further out in Ontario. It was a community that was at the end of the Underground Railroad. So he grew up with a lot of, like, you know, black kids. And he was apparently this unique youth brought him to become instrumental as a kind of a record keeper, as documenting a bunch of civil rights demonstrators and anti-war demonstrators in the United States during the 1960s. And even in other places like Cuba, during the Communist Revolution, and eventually coming back to Canada and documenting the redress movement for Japanese Canadians. So really powerful stuff, and I didn't get to see it all because our parking time ran out. But now that I have annual passes, I can go back again.
Yeah, I've never actually been to the art gallery myself. I've been looking for an excuse to check that out. But yeah, those sound fascinating. I know the whole you know, Japanese internment is one of, you know, Canada's greatest shames that I'm learning more about. And it sounds like a sort of very insightful exploration of that.
Yeah, there was an interesting film that was being played in one corner of the exhibit. And, you know, obviously you can sit down and watch all of it by local Vancouver filmmaker Cindy Mochizuki, is I believe her name, about Tamio Wakayama. It was interesting to see how active he was in kind of just global movements for, you know, human rights. And obviously to our American listeners, he played a role in the civil rights movements, like down in Selma, Alabama. It's remarkable seeing a lot of the pieces and seeing how relevant they are today to some of the kind of ICE raids and kind of bone-chilling transgressions that you're seeing on the media day in, day out. And that's apparently what really inspired him to move all the way down from Ontario, drove down in a Volkswagen Beetle to Selma, Alabama to start documenting. So, yeah, really cool stuff. It's a small art gallery. It's probably too much to see in one day, but it has basically four floors. The fourth floor is a permanent Emily Carr exhibit and local Indigenous art exhibit. So that's well worth seeing as well. But that one doesn't change, so you can kind of go see it. And the real draw is the kind of the seasonal, the short term exhibits, which Excellent. Were all knockouts this time.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out soon.
Very cool. Okay, I'm done. My throat is sore. Yours is too,
yes,
I imagine.
Yes, and Teddy's continues to circle. So, yeah, I think we're going to wrap it there.
All right. So, Dana's voice is just totally lost now, so I guess I'll wrap it up. Thank you all for listening to the show. Of course, this has been the Omni Gamers Club podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. You can reach us via social media. We're on Blue Sky at Omni Gamers Club. I'm on social media as markyuasa.bsky.social. At Blue Sky, and Daniel, your name is?
You can find me at boardgamefeast.bluesky.social, I guess it probably is. Yeah, so you can find us there. If you have any questions or comments on today's topics, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. We post our episodes to YouTube if you haven't subscribed to us there. And if you want to listen to our older episodes, you can catch them only in audio form on a podcatcher of your choosing. We'd love to hear your feedback. It gives us inspiration to keep making these episodes. And join the club. Let us know what demos you've been playing at Steam or what exhibits are at your local art gallery.
Yes, thank you for listening, and thanks for putting up with Ted here, who's decided to come back one final time to say goodbye as well.
Third leg of the podcast. All right. Special guest Ted appears again. So, until next time, folks, I hope you have a balanced diet of games.
Thanks. Bye.
Cheers.